Oh, I'm thinking, why don't we talk about you? How long have you been at UAF, Dale, and what is the UAF setting compared to your previous work experience at Las Vegas?
Well, I've been here about 3 years now. Came from Las Vegas, Nevada, where I was chief of police of the campus police department there. The main difference between the two settings is the police department down there was just that. It was a commissioned police department by statute. And we had no student patrol officers or student security, whereas up here the majority or the bulk of the department runs on student help. Of course, we have our full-time people, professional people, that are supervisors and administer the department, but the basic patrol and campus coverage is done by student patrol officers.
Is that unique? And when you say student help, are they doing everything that your professional staff is doing?
The student people are doing a tremendous job. There's just no question that they're doing a tremendous bit of work on the campus here. They're trained by myself. We've had the Alaska State Troopers in for training programs. We've had Fairbanks Police Department in for training programs. We've had Fort Wainwright Military Police up here for training. They're getting a real good training background to accomplish what they need to do on this campus. And subsequently, they are doing a great job. We've got a good group.
How are the students selected, and do they work for just a semester, or are they on for a year or two?
They're selected by the use of both written and oral interviews. Background checks are run on them, both through the university, their association with the university, past employment, friends. We run criminal record checks on them. The basis for their selection is on personality, how they present themselves, their maturity, their discretion, and how they think out their answers, both in written and in an oral form. We have to have somebody that can work within the campus community and relate both to members of the campus community and the thousands of visitors that come here each year.
Is it easier from your point of view for the students, the student officers, to work with the students on campus than let's say a police officer that or police officers, professional police officers that might be the case on other campuses? I mean, is there some advantage for these students dealing with their fellow students?
Well, I think every campus, each setting is different. We had a tremendous rapport with the campus community in Las Vegas. I think we have as good, if not better, rapport up here. This is working good. This is working very, very good. I think it's just in the people that are on the department and how they deal with different incidents and problems. So I don't think one works better than the other. It's just the quality of the people that are dealing with the public.
In looking over the past 3 years that you've been here, what do you feel have been some of your major accomplishments or things that have happened within the department that you particularly feel good about?
Well, first of all, I feel good about the quality of people that we have. We're very, very selective, very sensitive to who's representing us on the campus and who's representing the campus to the community. We're very noticeable, obviously, in the uniforms and in the level of service that we give. One of the things that has, in fact, increased is as the level of service that we do on campus, everything from service requests of assistance to answering calls, disturbances, to investigating incidents or crimes on the campus. There's just a myriad of things that we do.
Are you saying security is more than making arrests or breaking up fights?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, probably 90% of our time is non-criminal related. In fact, we're now in the process of taking over another level of service for the community or the campus community. So we're giving more and more service all the time. Many of the things that the public sees, unfortunately, is simply the campus officer on patrol in the parking lots looking for the parking violations or enforcing the parking regulations, but it goes much, much deeper than that on a 24-hour basis. We're open 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and we do an awful lot of things not related specifically to enforcement of rules or regulations or criminal activities.
What is this newest level of service that you're going to be providing?
Well, it's still in the process, as we haven't implemented it yet, but it has to do with answering calls of assistance after hours for the power plant and ascertaining at that time whether or not to call out the specialist to repair or fix things in the middle of the night. Campus officer will respond to calls and then make that decision at that time. And they'll be trained for that here very shortly.
The United States and the world who need our assets, our potential and our resources. It is our job to make a future for ourselves, not just be a supplier of raw materials. This means commerce, industry, business, with no degradation of the state as we know it and as we want it. This means involvement of all Alaskans in the investment in the future. We must use the engineering and science talents and developments to assure that the future is compatible with our lifestyle. The needs of the engineering school are paramount. First, we must remain accredited by the National Accrediting Agency, our Accrediting Board for Engineering and Technology, ABET. The recent inspection of Earl's and my schools by a visiting team pointed out the shortage of faculty, the limitations of space, and the obsolescence of our equipment. Their report won't be published until August, but we know that attention must be applied to these areas. We've been working heavily with Chancellor O'Rourke and President Barton to resolve these. And speaking of the Chancellor, he and Reverend Morrison and I were out fishing last summer in waters infested by sharks. And unfortunately, I hooked a good one and I got excited and fell overboard. About that time, one of these triangular shape came zooming at me, and then another one from another direction. And Morrison was proposing that he and the Chancellor pray for...
The question is, what is the nature of the excavation which led to the finds? How did the finders of the bodies react to their find, and what is the nature of the difference, or the origin, the source of the difference, and the preservation between the different bodies? To answer the first part of that question, yes, they did realize what they were doing. They saw that it was a human body. We were notified as soon as they made the find.
But it sounded as though earlier you were saying that some of these bones were scattered about.
That is correct.
Maybe I'll try that one. People have been digging in that area systematically for a long time. Right? They dig up and down the bluff edge and so forth. As a matter of fact, it's fairly easy when one walks along the beach to look up and see these mounds where they're eroding. The soil changes are fairly obvious. You can, in some cases, see little raised places along the beach, and you can also see house parks, for example, eroding. So finding a location in which to mine for artifacts is no problem, and it happens all the time along that stretch of coast. Now, second, the actual first discovery of a bone from a human from that location would be difficult for us to establish. It is the case that there are a lot of bones in these mounds, and it's also the case that, especially dealing with a disarticulated, with a bone that comes up, just comes popping out, as it were, one is not necessarily expected to recognize it. Although, if one has been a subsistence hunter in that area, and one is familiar with bones, people who know their stuff have no trouble identifying the species and so on. Okay? And it's also not unusual for people to, in digging in that circumstance, you have to keep in mind that they're digging in frozen ground, in many cases with a pick when they get into to some depth, and so you're dealing with a relatively small exposure and so on, and at any one particular point in time, they might not know that they were dealing with a complete skeleton, for example. Okay? So the discovery is an interesting concept in that regard. It's hard to tell exactly when. The thing that seemed to trigger the concern and the anxiety expressed by the individual who encountered it was the discovery of an exposure of feet. And in that case, I don't mean bones. I mean feet with flesh and desiccated skin and so forth, and one in which you could even see the curls on the skin and so on, the toenails and that sort of thing. That is what basically caused the individual some concern and caused him to come literally, I guess, running to us to see what was going on. Okay, and so at that point in time, that individual in an agitated state came to us and said, basically, "Oh my God, look what I found!" Not entirely, but and wanted some advice and so on. And then his anxiety was apparently relatively short-lived because he went back there later in the afternoon and continued to dig. Right? And in the process, I guess one could say colloquially, he continued to trash the particular find and so on. In the meantime, he is alerting it to us, let us take a number of steps at that point to notify the authorities to seek permission from the landowner for access and so on. I mean, all these niceties that we go through habitually, but that people who are digging illicitly don't bother. Okay? I hope that clarifies.
Yeah, that was this summer.
Yes.
Okay.
Perhaps I ought to add that in the loose and scattered material that I went through, I found two teeth that don't fit into any of these five individuals that we have identified. So there was certainly another individual either there and has disappeared, or we haven't uncovered yet.
Archaeologically, we made observations of seven individuals, but we have parts for only six. Five more or less complete, and one represented by the teeth just mentioned by Dr. Zimmerman.
What about the seventh?
The seventh is completely gone. This is due to the activities of the clandestine excavator on the 28th of June of this summer. And that is the one body which was found with its feet projecting out of the bluff edge section, and which apparently was intact. But at the time, we did not have access to the terrain. This was private land where we had no permission to excavate, nor was that part of our stated scope of work. So we had no sanctions, no right to inhibit this person in his activity.
To clarify that just a little bit, it was the case that the individual, when he first came to us, had exposed feet which had flesh and skin intact on them. Okay? We have not obtained a specimen of that sort. Okay? Those were exposed. The body which we removed on the 28th of June was intact and so on, and did not, and was all covered up and was in a frozen state and did not represent that individual. I asked Dr. Zimmerman yesterday if there was any indication from his examination of the body that would indicate that either, number one, feet were missing, say, or that part of the body had still flesh on it, say, in the feet, and the rest of it had none, and so on. And he had no indication that that might be the case. Okay, so we cannot state conclusively that there was an additional body there, or what happened to it. It may have gone down the bluff edge, it may have got buried, it may have been taken away, and we just have no idea. Okay. But I want to emphasize that it is not our conclusion that there is another body roaming around Barrow somewhere. Okay, we really can't say that, and we're trying real hard to stick fairly tight to the information as we have it.
Anchorage, can you still hear okay?
Pardon me, who was that last speaker?
Al Deacon.
Thank you. Everything's coming in clear down here.
Do you have questions from your end?
You were talking about the artifacts that were discovered in the house. What are the nature of the artifacts?
Yes, this is Raymond Newell. The nature of the artifacts are the full range of tools, clothing, equipment, storage containers that one would find in an average Inupiat house. Specifically, we have found three pairs of mukluks ranging in size. We have found one pair of polar bear comic look, that is to say, trousers and mukluk attached all on one piece, typical piece of female winter clothing. We have one child, small child's parka. We have a larger parka. We have the hood to an ugruk or bearded seal seal intestine raincoat. We have mittens. We have varying sorts of sorts and sizes of skin bags, the most spectacular of which was a sewing bag containing all of the traditional implements for sewing. Another was a bound bag of barbed bone and one chipped flint arrow point. Another bound bag of bolus weights and pieces of ivory and bone, which were in the process of being worked. Some 9 bent wood buckets, 8 of which were found in an upright position. We've been able to salvage their content. The contents of those buckets are here in Fairbanks and will be analyzed by the people here. In addition to that, we have a number of fishing implements found in wall sills, little nooks and crannies in the wall. Pieces of bows, pieces of arrows, snow shovel fragments, a number of ornaments in the form of earrings and perforated amulets, a carved staff, I suppose one could say, in the form of a goose head, and another small carved wooden fish, something on the order of something that looks very much like a an Arctic flounder.
Pot.
Oh yes, one complete pot.
A little ivory
pot.
A little ivory duck.
Yeah, and many small artifacts of carved ivory.
MIT and Stanford. It's hoped that they will return to this state. The unfortunate part is that you usually stay employed in the state or in the near environs of where you go to school. Now, whether it has really harmed us or not, is we have no measure. Right now, because the enrollment are being limited in the lower 48, we find a tremendous number of students are coming back here. They're tired of being taught by graduate students who can't speak English. They're tired of going to classes where they can only listen to a faculty member. They can't ever have an opportunity to visit with them. And this worries me about up here. When I start to have student to faculty ratios of 21, 22 students per faculty member, you say that isn't very many. But when you remember the amount of work that these faculty members must do besides teaching, there leaves almost no time at all for them to interface with the students. And so I think it's essential to at least add 5 to 6 more faculty members to my school, and I don't know how many more you're shooting for, Earl, almost immediately, about the same number. Yes? I'm talking to Jeff. That's one. The other thing is that I'm trying to get the problems delineated and distributed to the general populace of this state so that the decisions can be made in the legislature to make an investment in the future. We need to spread, in essence, what I've tried to say here, what I've tried to say in the front of the Northern Engineer, that we are in desperate need of support by the legislature. I think the regents have given us a very fine amount of support. Yes, right now one of the problems has been and continues to be an inability on our part to provide the oil industry with the educational programs that they need where they need them. This year we have initiated a program of providing videotape courses on the North Slope in the hopes that we can now build a bridge to establish some rapport with the oil industry, and hopefully that we will then be a recipient of some of their support.
Jim? You spoke of your budget for travel and the need to increase it. Do you have also engineering students and schools from other areas traveling here to meet in our area?
Yeah, we have about 20% of non-Alaskans going to school here, in the engine school. Is that what you meant, Jim?
Well, I meant from other schools coming here for conferences, your senior people, your teachers, your instructors are coming here for conference and visiting and seeing what you're doing here in the School of Engineering.
Yeah, we have a pretty good number of turnouts for our short courses. One that was generated by Eb Rice on Arctic Engineering is not only do people come here to take the course, which this year is the one we're giving on the North Slope too. We have about pretty close to 100 people in that this past semester. Eb has been invited to take a team to Tulsa, to Seattle, to San Francisco, to Denver. Forgotten where the other one is. Five places this year alone to provide this kind of education program. And I have received an invite or an invitation from the National Conference on the Advancement of Research to invite them to hold their 1984 meeting here in Fairbanks. This is the first time this prestigious group has ever asked to be invited anywhere. And we have issued such an invitation, and I'm praying that we will have some kind of convention facilities in time to hold this meeting.
That's what I wanted you to say.
But it is vital to be able to bring people from the outside here to receive the education that we can provide. Any other questions? Ladies and gentlemen of the chamber, honored guests, I've been very happy to be invited. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Be happy to respond anytime.
Black and brown bears, grizzlies, wolves, and wolverines. So we'll be dovetailing our efforts closely with McDonnell and Kessel, and also with the fish and game researchers.
Now, during this winter, whatever, four season check, you're saying, let me see if I'm getting this right, your key time are right after freeze up, during, just before breakup of the lowest assistance of
the harsher time of the year, right?
And then during the summer, which is reproductive and basically getting ready for the summer.
Right, yeah. Now those are three intense periods that we have mentioned. There are some others that are not going to be at the same intensity, but we'll go out checking on locations of animals. We will be doing muskrat and beaver surveys, for example, which we've just done and we'll be finishing up within the next couple of weeks. And that's really interesting because muskrats that freeze up, they establish holes in the ice. And then through the winter, they begin to bring up materials, vegetation from the bottom of the lake. I'm
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Program here at the university. We're essentially just a broker and middle organization in this. The people that are really most knowledgeable about the findings in Beryl are seated at the table before you, and that's Dr. Al Deacon. There are available sheets with the right spelling and names and so forth. Dr. Deacon, as you see on your sheets from the State University of New York, Binghamton, and is director of the Utqiagvik Archaeology Project in Beryl. Also with Utqiagvik is Dr. Raymond Newell, who is the green sweater. When he's not in Beryl, Dr. Newell is at the Rich University in Groningen, Netherlands. Dr. Jack Lobdell is representing Frank Moulin and Associates, the engineering management firm that's involved in a large construction project in Beryl.
Could you point? I'm not sure who's who.
I'm Al Deacon.
Al Deacon.
Jack
Lobdell. Ray Newell.
Mike Zimmerman.
Mike Zimmerman. Dr. Zimmerman is the pathologist from Holloman Medical College. He's probably had more experience with medical studies of ancient human remains than anyone else in the country. So I think with those introductions, we'll let it go. This is wired into the room at the nursing school in Anchorage. There are some people from the media sitting in by teleconference. So I may take the liberty of repeating questions so the people in Anchorage can understand the question as well as the answer. And when you reply to questions, if you would grab one of these brown mics and push to talk, that would let the people in Beryl, Anchorage hear what you're saying. Floor is open.
Can you just begin by telling us what the status of the autopsies were?
There were five individuals in this collection. They were apparently all members of the same family. And the oldest of them is a woman probably in her about 50 years old. That body was extremely well preserved, the best preserved of all of them, and actually the best preserved ancient human body I've ever seen. Then the next youngest was a woman probably in her early 20s, and she too was extremely well preserved. Both of those bodies were intact, and I was able to do almost standard autopsy procedures on them, and they both died of crushing chest injuries. They had multiple rib fractures and other evidence that they had been crushed and were unable to breathe. Then there were three other bodies that were very badly fragmented, actually skeletonized. And these are younger individuals. One is probably about 15, another about 12, and another about 9. All of these ages are very preliminary at this point, and we have a number of very specific tests that will be done out in the lower 48 when I bring the specimens back. And I really can't establish a cause of death for any of these other individuals because of the fragmentation, the poor preservation, and the fact that they were totally skeletonized. And the autopsies have been completed on all of these. I'm going to be just going through the fragmentary remains for today and tomorrow, and doing really more of an anthropologic analysis than a medical type analysis on those. But the autopsies on the intact bodies are completed, and they've been put back into fairly complete condition and are ready for reburial in Beryl.
What the bodies that were found intact, what depth were they at, and what, I guess I'd ask the archaeologist, what depth were the bodies that were found intact, and what depth were the bodies that were skeletonized?
The two bodies that were found intact, both of them were very, very close to the presently active surface. That is to say, they were some 30, 35 centimeters below the top of the bluff edge. But you have to understand that this bluff edge is actively being recycled, reworked, and eroded both by natural processes and by clandestine excavators. At the time that the two sets of finds were made, all skeletal remains were found on approximately the same level, no more than a 5 or 10 centimeter difference between them, and very close to the present surface.
How do you account for the difference in the preservation of the bodies?
The difference in preservation of the bodies is accountable for because there was a difference in where people were excavating and a difference in the care of the different collectors or relic diggers in handling of the human remains. The first set of human remains were completely taken out and scattered. This is why we have some missing individuals. One other was seen, recognized for what it was, and then the person could be prevailed upon to cease and desist his clandestine excavation activities. The same sequence of events, a very, very similar sequence of events obtained at the second finding of human remains on the 19th of July.
Okay, you want to give us that chronology again? I'm not sure I follow it.
All right, the 28th of June, the first set of bodies were discovered and reported to us at our field laboratory.
Now, were those the bones?
No, it was one complete body and some bones. In the course of our investigation of the site and its situation, as we discovered at a slightly lower level, meaning 5 or 10 centimeter difference, another in situ frozen body. On the 29th of June, we were requested to assist in the exhumation of that frozen body and to collect what other scattered bones were to be found down the tail slope of the bluff edge. At that time, we were not given the opportunity to make any archaeological observations or to check for the archaeological context in which these bodies had been found. This occurred after the second report of bodies on the 19th of July. At that time, again, people digging on the bluff edge came to our laboratory with skeletal remains and asked us what this was. We went out, confirmed its nature, notified public safety and the magistrate, notified the landowner. They, in turn, requested us to help them with the exhumation of the body. We proceeded to do that, and the next day contacted the elders and people at Moulins and the borough to establish the protocol in which to do this. At that time, there were clearly evident a well-preserved body frozen in situ in what was quite clearly a house structure, and fragmentary remains, largely skeletonized, of one and possibly a second. During the course of excavation, it became clear that we had two skeletonized bodies and one completely frozen and intact body found inside a very well-preserved and intact house.
What sort of time lag was there between when the first bodies were reported to you and when they were found up there? Do you have any idea on that?
Yes, 27 days.
And who did the discovering then, and are other investigations underway on the North Slope, as far as who found the bodies?
The bodies were found by Barrow residents digging on the bluff edge for artifacts.
Increase, are you hearing reasonably well?
We're hearing the responses reasonably well, but we'd like some identification who's making the statement, as well as when other questions are asked, if you can repeat the questions, we'll know what you're responding to.
Okay, I'll repeat the questions. By the way, the first speaker that was discussing autopsy findings was Dr. Zimmerman. That should be on your sheet, and the gentleman that was describing the excavation was Dr. Ray Newell.
I bluff edge to discover. I assume that the borough residents who are working on the bluff edge, this clandestine activity you were talking about, find the artifacts and then attempt to sell them. Is that correct?
Most of the artifacts which are mined on the bluff edge are indeed for sale to tourists who come to Barrow in the summertime, yes.
As an archaeologist, then are there plans for you as an archaeologist or for other archaeological teams to actually go up, take over the digging, and continue more extensive investigations, assuming there would be other settlements or other homes?
At the present time, the question had to do with what our future plans are with regard to excavation. We've been in Barrow for the last 2 years, and the nature of this particular find is such that we will probably not be able to excavate the house in its entirety this summer, because the number of days of excavation left this summer are very few. And it is expected that the house itself will be excavated by the end of next week, and all of its contents removed and so forth. We're still in the process of excavation. I would expect that we would have been able to remove the house, its floor, and its contents by that time. This, however, butts up against the gentleman's house, or one of his structures on his property. We expect that the tunnel entrance and the kitchen, as well as any outside activity areas and so forth, probably lie in an undisturbed state underneath that structure. So two factors combine to mean that we will probably not be able to excavate the entire property or the entire house this summer. The proximity of the other additional structure and the fact that we're getting frozen out and we're about to lose our ability to dig up there. So I think it's fair to say that given the rather spectacular nature of the finds themselves, that we will seek additional funding from perhaps a variety of sources to continue up there, and as long as the people are interested in and willing to have us do so.
You cooperated with the Barrow Village per se as far as agreeing to rebury the individuals in the Barrow and so forth. Any plans to incorporate the Native Corporation into the search and research, or how are they being involved?
Barrow, as you may know, is a complex community place, and the complexities of that are such that I'm not certain just who ultimately may be interested or involved. We have, however, had the excellent support from anyone we've talked to up there, who's administratively or politically responsible, and we have had the good fortune to have the support of the North Slope Borough in this particular endeavor, and I would hope that our relationship with them can continue, and I certainly expect that no matter what happens, their involvement will be significant, in large part because it's their long-term intention to create a museum in Barrow, and it is our hope that arrangements can be made so that at least the materials which we're obtaining this summer and last, and hopefully next, since your question led that way, would be useful to establish a core collection, right, from the 19th century, which would form an interpretive and a research collection there in Barrow as a major component of that museum effort.
Can one of you describe to us what exactly happened 150 to 250 years ago when the ice or whatever it was came up and crushed the house? What's your surmise on that?
The best guess is that we are dealing with a family sleeping in. Dealing with the family at night sleeping in their house, and that quite possibly or quite probably rafting ice being uplifted by a combination of high tide and wind was building up against the bluff edge, and then a raft broke off and crushed the house, pushing it not only down but, as it were, backwards, so that we have a skewing of what should be nice straight vertical wall planks to the south, and a sigmoid curve occurring on both sides as this thing collapses. It must have happened rather quickly, because we have at present no indication of people trying to get out.
did the planks come from?
The planks are hand-hewn from driftwood. Before the introduction of European-style iron sheet iron stoves, there was plenty of driftwood all along the North Slope.
And then it was a sod house, basically, with the driftwood, or what was the
No, the structure is one of hewn driftwood sleepers, which form the foundation. On top of that, if you have a foundation sill, standing wall planks, saddle roof, supported by a large ridge pole, and then a layer of sods, certainly two thick, two, even sometimes three thick at the bottom, apexing toward the top as a single layer over the top of the walls and the roof.
And this is pre-white contact altogether, no whalers, no nothing up there?
As far as we can tell, there is not a, well, we certainly know that there is not a single European or Euro-American artifact in the house in which the bodies were found. That everything which we have found is traditional, late, prehistoric, proto-historic Eskimo.
What sort of concerns are voiced by the residents up there with your digs?
Many and various. That our reception in the community has been positive, both in terms of the everyday man in the street all the way up to the borough level. Their interest is one of preserving their cultural heritage. Their interest is that of mitigating any impact due to construction, due to the expansion of facilities and services in such a manner that it will be preserved and also, as Dr. Deakin has said, will become a permanent part of a museum, which they see as a very active repository of not only artifacts but also the traditions of their cultural heritage.
What's the status of the artifacts that you found so far, and why weren't any of them brought down here up for review?
At the present time, the artifacts are in our field laboratory. One of the most important concerns that you have when you excavate artifacts of this nature, and I do wish to emphasize the fact that we're dealing with complete artifacts by and large, not fragments or whatever. One of the biggest problems you run into is that when you take them out of what has basically been a frozen state for the last century and a half or two, you have real problems with them drying out, with the possibility of exfoliation, layers separating, and so on. Okay? It would not be wise for us to put them out and dry them off rather abruptly and so on. So they've been undergoing, since their exposure, a period of rather intense conservation. And by and large, the wooden artifacts, for example, are soaked in a mixture of polyethylene glycol and water. The polyethylene glycol is designed to enter the interstices in the wood and exchange with the water that's already there so that the artifact itself ultimately will not dry out and will not fall apart. The point then is that we're right in the middle of conserving most of these artifacts at the present time. They are therefore not easily traveled. Most of them are soaking in that kind of solution. The soaking may take up to as much as 2 or 3 weeks. So the artifacts, while we could have brought them down, as a matter of fact, I mentioned that interest to our laboratory director, Randy Peterson, and Randy said he didn't think it was a very good idea, and so we decided not to. So that they don't travel well, and they're right in the middle right now of being conserved.
Dr. Zimmerman, can you? You said these are the best preserved bodies you've ever dealt with. Can you go into a little bit more detail about their state of preservation and exactly what that means in terms of internal organs and blood and fluids and that kind of thing?
Sure. These bodies were apparently frozen very shortly after death, so there was very little damage to the tissues, and they have been frozen ever since. We did see some evidence of contamination of the body by fungi, which can occur quite quickly after death. But as far as the gross examination is concerned, all of the internal organs were present and did show a number of pathologic changes. Like most people living in less developed societies, the lungs showed very intensive deposition of soot pigment. They're actually quite black and look like the classic coal miner's black lung. This is something we find in many groups, and it's because of living in a relatively small, confined house with, as in the case of the Eskimos, a seal oil fire. The most bodies tend to dehydrate as they are, even in the frozen state, and these weighed approximately half the normal weight, and the organs were about the same, so that I was able to do an absolutely standard autopsy examination and demonstrate these various injuries that they had, the diseases that they had. The condition of the lung is called anthracosis. The older woman also had a moderate degree of atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, involving her aorta, the major vessel coming out of the heart. But the real value of doing this type of autopsy is that we're going to be able to find evidence of the various diseases that these people had. The immediate cause of death is, to a pathologist, quite obvious, that their chests were crushed. And the point of interest for the people of Barrow is in what other diseases they had and what relationship this has to the diseases that the Eskimos are liable to at the present time.
Can somebody mark on the garments that the individuals were wearing when they were found?
That the bodies which were recovered intact appeared to have been naked. One of them was lying on or in a robe or some sort of parka and lying on top of other items of clothing which appeared to be served as a mattress or a sort of pillow.
Are we assuming this occurred in the spring then? I'm wondering why the bodies froze so immediately if it was warm. Was the ice breaking up so that there was water pushing the ice up, or when did it occur?
Well, it'll certainly will not be warm. It's not often warm in Barrow. And
Was it break up though so that there was water pushing the ice up?
Most probably. But you can also have the pack ice being pushed up against the shore, against the cliff edge in this case, long before breakup. So we have no real clear idea as to season, except looking for the most probable agent to give us this collapse, to give us this catastrophic death of the family at what appears to have been the hours of darkness when people were sleeping. One then comes to these sorts of events of rafting ice, which are known both in terms of the oral tradition of the Inupiaq people in the North Slope and are historically recorded. There has been a study of these sorts of ice events by the Geophysical Institute here at this university with concomitant publication. So we know that these types of events, giving us that magnitude of shifting and rafting and collapse of large pieces of pack ice, do occur. There are folk traditions relating this type of event which have been recorded anthropologically.
Matt, the freezing of the body is actually not a very unusual occurrence. Once you stop heating the interior of a structure of that sort, it sits on ground which is permanently frozen and much colder than so on. So it undoubtedly, I would expect, froze from the bottom rather than from the top, which of course is one additional reason why the individual lying on the floorboards was part of the best preserved.
Anchorage, are you still hearing okay?
Yeah, so far, but we're hearing real well.
Are there questions from Anchorage?
Somebody needs to turn this tape over.
Do you have any indication whether this was an isolated house by itself as part of a larger village?
Tell them who you are.
This is Jack Mondell. The Utiaotic Village site is a fairly large site, and what I think I'd like to do now is turn this over to Al Deacon to give a brief description of the size of the village and the locations where they are doing the testing, and also the location of this particular mound.
The last 2 years, we've been investigating a large number of mounds of human origin in Barrow. The number of mounds which we've looked at so far and have mapped is 60, and we have been investigating approximately a dozen to 15 of those over the last 2 years. They are scattered across a portion of the village, or the city of Barrow, over more than 1,000 feet along the bluff edge and in a rough semicircle extending into the inland from that. We've investigated houses close to the bluff edge, an area owned by the city, which is a historic preserve. We've investigated a number of mounds which are on private property. And at the present time, we're conducting excavations in a Kurigi or men's house adjacent to a ravine which flows down, which has an intermittent stream in it that flows to the sea and cuts into or goes around this particular mound in which the present find was located. It's important for people to understand, I think, that the mound that the house was found in is in the middle, or basically of the major distribution of houses. It was exposed in large part because of continuing erosion of the bluff edge by water going down and by the sea coming in. And the erosion is made more rapid, perhaps, and certainly the surface horizons are being affected by people who are actively digging there for artifacts. Okay. The mound itself was not intended to be the focus of our intention this summer. It was only when the find started to appear that we couldn't ignore it, obviously, and since people were bringing these specimens to us, and it was only at that point in time when we finally came to understand the nature of that deposit that its significance became apparent, and we started to take some steps with Frangel and Associates and others to gain access to the property and to hopefully, as I think we're starting to see, to realize whatever scientific significance may prevail there. So it is but one part of a much larger and ongoing research and effort that's been conducted there over the last 2 years. The excavations in other houses are different in character because most of these other houses have been abandoned systematically, and therein lies, I think, the archaeological potential of this particular find. The systematic abandonment of houses means, in part, that people, when they left, took a number of important things with them. They did not leave artifacts necessarily in the spot in which they were used. They, just like other people leaving a hotel room, perhaps, as we did this morning, took all of their goodies and packed them in the box and took them away. Okay. Here, however, in this particular house, you find a house which has been catastrophically abandoned, although I guess technically speaking these people never abandoned it, they were interred there. nevertheless, the artifacts themselves were left in the exact location at which the previous use had occurred, right? And that's fairly important. We have never found a house in our previous excavations that has that characteristic. We occasionally find some things which are lost, some things which people forget to come back for, and some things that people throw out, but we have yet to find, or prior to this time we had not found, a house where its entire contents was in the exact location where people had been using it, what you might call, I suppose, a Pompeii type effect. Okay.
Did you find any artifacts that surprised you, or you just can't figure out what they are?
Those people familiar with the Nupiat technology in the 19th century know that they are what some have called a really gadget-oriented people. It's a lot of fun, to a certain extent, trying to figure out just exactly what some of these things were used for. We're helped because of a really fine ethnography done by Murdoch in the 1880s, and that's a lot of fun, but it means that you have to dig with that in one hand and then travel in the other, to a certain extent. We're also fortunate to be able to ask elders in the community what these things may have been used for, and we play stump the elders from time to time, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. Actually, I think the most interesting or perplexing problem at the present time is that the house itself has no lamps in it, so far as we can tell. And we know from experience where they ought to be, and they're simply not there. I have no explanation for that at the present time. They may be elsewhere, or they could have been removed by person or persons unknown after the house was destroyed, although that's not likely, and that's also the sort of thing that one shouldn't have done at that time.
Just interject here. This is Jack Londell again. Let me just interject that this is a case where we have, for example, a couple of missing artifacts in the case of the lamps themselves, but we have biological data from these autopsies in the form of the anthracosis condition that indicates certainly that these people were using this type of artifact, even though we do not have the artifact. So in this case, the biology provides us with the indication the artifacts were certainly in use.
Can you tell us, it sounded as though